Oh my goodness. Christmas is less than a week away. Imagine that. Which also means that another year is almost over as well. All of us have memories of Christmas, good or bad, though likely mostly good, I'd hope. And we're each about to add another chapter to our own personal Christmas memory scrapbooks that we keep tucked up in our heads, or maybe in actual scrapbooks, for those of you that do that sort of thing. For a great many people, Christmas has its roots firmly in religious connections. That's certainly the case for me and my family. For a lot of people, there are also secular or cultural aspects to the holiday that are celebrated. Today, because Christmas is so close, let's give thought to a number of ideas connected to what is arguably the biggest, most celebrated holiday on our calendar. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. At the risk of sounding like a paid advertisement on TV, if you are 50 and over, one of my earliest memories of Christmas is the high level of anticipation I had each fall of the three Christmas catalogs showing up in the mail: JCPenney's, Montgomery Ward, and Sears. How many of you remember those catalogs? They were thick and had a sequence to them, with the toy section always found in the back. My friends and I always marveled over the many things we didn't have, that actually existed, that we absolutely needed to have, even if it was actually pretty infrequent that we ever came to own any of those items. Still, the memories of all those shiny, cool toys in those catalogs is one of my earliest memories tied to Christmas. Perhaps one of the most common items connected to Christmas is the likely centerpiece of any decorating you have done in your home, the Christmas tree. It's not an uncommon thing for families to set aside the day after Thanksgiving as the day the tree goes up, at least for those not in urban areas going through combat shopping on that day. A difficult decision for some is what type of tree to put up, an artificial tree or a real one. During my childhood, I saw both sides of this coin. My mom was a staunch proponent of fake trees. My grandparents were equally adamant about real ones. I'm not going to try and tell you which direction you should go. That's a personal decision. Nor am I going to launch into the merits and pitfalls of each. I will say that my grandparents exerted far greater influence over me than my mom, and I think a real one trumps a fake one, pretty much every time. I will say that the artificial trees being sold today look so much more real than fake trees did when I was a kid. I saw an article once about fake trees that said the fake trees of yesteryear were essentially big green toilet brushes. Having spent many years helping Mom put up our tree, I'd say that observation was spot on. For those that choose a real tree and cut your own locally, the odds are pretty decent that what you have in your living room is a black spruce. Black spruces are found throughout most of our state, and they are uber common around here. They are partial to wet soils and bogs, and they are not the largest of conifers, reaching top heights of maybe 60 feet. The bark is thin and scaly and ranges from gray to almost black. They are also something of an irregular conifer. What I mean by that is that they can have more of a scraggly look to them than other conifers. And while there are plenty of them out there, finding a good one to serve as a Christmas tree can take a bit of looking. On the other hand, if you're partial to a Charlie Brown-looking tree, you should have no trouble at all finding one to fit with that look. So what about the presents you plan to put under the tree? The outdoor sports, assuming you're purchasing for someone who is an outdoor lover, can provide an endless list of ideas for gifts, a topic that was covered on here 2 weeks ago. I mentioned those gifts can run the gamut in terms of price and size. Small stuff, like fishing lures or a box of 22 shells, make great stocking stuffers. More traditional under-the-tree gifts might include a new pair of snowshoes. Well, there is snow in the forecast next week. Or a new fly rod, which is still a great idea, but it's going to make the recipient have to wait just a bit. I'll confess that I don't hold out any hope for some of the things on my wish list, which is just as well. A Winchester Model 1895 just doesn't fit very well in a stocking. And I've heard that new snowgoes are tough to wrap, and our tree just doesn't have that kind of clearance beneath it. Speaking of stockings, do you have one? Do you put them up at your place? Ever wonder about why we do that? I've read a couple of different stories about where that tradition originated. One story from the Scandinavian parts of the world holds that it was the god Odin who used to deliver gifts and the stockings were hung to give his flying horse treats to eat on the night when he delivered those gifts. Odin would then replace those horse treats with gifts and candy. Another story says that stockings were hung by the chimney to dry, and St. Nicholas began leaving gifts in them. Whatever their origins, stockings make for great places to drop in a bit of candy or jerky, and useful but small items like headlamps, fire starters, pocket knives, lures, and ammo. Many of the symbols of Christmas are a bit more contemporary. Take, for example, a red-nosed ungulate that's familiar around the world. It seems like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer has been around forever, doesn't it? Rudolph was actually a product of the mind of Robert L. May, a copywriter who wrote the poem in 1939, not all that long ago at all. He penned the poem to help lure new customers into the Montgomery Ward department store. That's right, Rudolph was a marketing ploy. Also, Rudolph was originally supposed to be a moose, but it was decided that a reindeer projected a warmer, friendlier image than a moose. For those of us who live around Bristol Bay, we know the truth. It would not matter whether Rudolph was a moose or a reindeer. They both taste great. Of course, in saying that, I'm mostly talking about caribou, not reindeer, right? So, what's the difference between a reindeer and a caribou? While there are some physical differences, such as cow reindeer typically have larger antlers than cow caribou, or reindeer bulls normally being a bit smaller than caribou bulls, the biggest difference is really pretty basic. Reindeer are domesticated. If, when I mentioned Rudolph, you pictured the TV special that airs annually, well, you'd probably not be alone in that. The TV show, by the way, first aired on NBC on Sunday, December 6, 1964. It was narrated by Burl Ives and featured the vocal talents of Canadian voice actress Billy Ray Richards as the voice of Rudolph. Let's stay on the topic of Rudolph just a bit longer. Several years ago, I put forth what I thought was a pretty solid argument for how Rudolph could actually exist. You know, as a real animal, and not just as a marketing gimmick. I mean, Christmas is the season of believing, right? Well, I'd like to touch on that again. Let's start with how a reindeer, or any ungulate for that matter, could have a glowing nose. The full name is Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, so we have to take into account the nose color. That's really pretty simple. Clearly, Rudolph is an albino reindeer. I could find no actual printed reference that states Rudolph has a normal brown coat of fur, only that he is a reindeer and his nose is red and it glows. It's a fact that albino reindeer do exist, and an albino reindeer's nose is pink, which kind of gets us into the realm of red. So now you're asking, okay, so it's red. How does it glow? Again, the answer is not all that hard to get at. If you'll think back to high school biology, we know that mutations occur in nature. We also know that mutations are a change in the DNA sequence within a chromosome or gene of an organism that results in the creation of a new characteristic or trait. Mutations can be inherited, or they can occur after conception and be caused by any number of factors. Those that occur after conception are called somatic mutations. I'm not making this up. Feel free to check it online or in a biology textbook. We also know that some organisms can produce their own light. The ability to do this is called bioluminescence. In bioluminescent organisms, chemical compounds mix together to produce what can be a very bright glow. It's the same way substances inside a light stick combine to make light. From my own childhood, the best example of this would be the fireflies we tried to catch each summer. Whole yards and fields would be lit up with the blinking glow of these insects. In the case of Rudolph, my theory is that he's a mutated albino caribou, and that his nose has mutated in such a way that it's capable of bioluminescence. And there you have it. Or, for any Brits that might be listening, Bob's your uncle. It's amazing how easy it is to figure these things out if you just give it a bit of thought. Short of a necropsy on the actual Rudolph, I think my theory sounds pretty darn plausible. As far as how he or any other reindeer could fly, my advice is to watch the somewhat entertaining movie Bulletproof Monk. They explain it there far better than I can in words here. Whatever traditions you have that are a part of your family, I wish you the very best. Have a safe and happy Christmas. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.